On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Thanksgiving is on the way, right around the corner, and it seemed like a wonderful opportunity when I got a new book, The Mayflower Pilgrim, Sifting Fact from Fable by Derek Wilson. It's from SPCK, which is the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge. It's distributed in the U.S. by Kregel Publication. Mr. Wilson is one of the United Kingdom's leading authors of history and historical fiction in a writing career that spans a half a century. He has written over 70 books, a Cambridge graduate where he studied history and theology. He has explored many aspects of the Reformation, including Out of the Storm, The Life of Martin Luther, A Brief History of Henry VIII, Reformer and Tyrant, A Brief History of the English Reformation, Religion, Politics, and Fear, and Mrs. Luther and Her Sisters, Women in the Reformation. Once again, his newest book, The Mayflower Pilgrim, Sifting Fact from Fable. Mr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today on the bookshelf.
My pleasure.
Often in the United States, we look at the Mayflower for what happened afterwards. We think about the pilgrims or the Puritans coming to America. We think about the first Thanksgiving. We think about the city on shining on the hill and so forth. And that's all well and good, but as you point out in the book, it was a long time coming before we got to that point, and we can't really understand the significance of what they were doing coming to America if we don't know what they were leaving back home. The book starts out more than a century back. Do we want to, how far back do you wish to go? Where would you like to start with the Henry VIII and the religious conflicts that arose during his reign and that of his children's?
Well, I think that if we had sort of 3 or 4 hours at our disposal, that might not be a bad idea. But since we haven't, I think things that I would like to try and pull out are those things that had the most effect on people at the time. And the most formative thing was the distribution of vernacular Bibles. Now, this made an enormous change to the way that English people did their religion. No longer did they just go along to church and watch the priest celebrate his mass. They were now taking part in the service. They could go home and read the Bible for themselves. And this also led to an enormous increase in the desire for education. So people were forming their own interpretations of what the Bible actually said.
And this makes everything different. The fact that they are able to read the Bible in English, and there's it's quite a torturous journey getting to that point. And as Mr. Wilson says, we don't have 3 hours, so we can't talk, unfortunately, about Wycliffe and Tyndale and all those that led up to the Bible being available in English. But this very fact that people could participate now in the interpretation of the Bible is what begins the enormous fractioning of the religious landscape in Great Britain, correct?
Absolutely right, yes. You had the Puritans were those who were not happy with the Church of England as it had become. It had not, in their view, distanced itself from the Church, and so they wanted to change. But then within that broad spectrum of Puritanism, there were various strands of people, of whom the most extreme were the separatists, who said, well, we simply cannot live with this church. We can't be doing with it. Now, the government at the time was not, can't be presented as persecutors. What the Queen wanted was a measure of outward conformity. She wasn't prepared to, as she said, make windows into men's souls and find out what they really believe, but as long as they went along to church on a Sunday, that was good enough. Besides, they couldn't do that. So you've got, amongst the Puritans, you've got those who, A, those who were grin and bear it, B, those who tried to change it, and C, those who just quit. And the separatists were the Pilgrim Fathers eventually emerged were among that latter group of people who just couldn't stomach it and went somewhere else.
And there really wasn't a lot of persecution at this point. People could dissent as long as they didn't make a big show of it, as long as they didn't lambaste the Queen and the Parliament in their sermons. The government was content to let them worship in whatever way that they felt most comfortable, once again, as long as they weren't stirring up dissension or saying anything treasonous. That's where it got dangerous for the speakers, correct?
Yeah, and it's Europe at this time is absolutely a seething cauldron of religious discord. I mean, England was at war with Spain, Catholic Spain, but then you had to look across the channel at France to see their 60 years of wars of religion where the most appalling things were happening, massacres and assassinations and war and towns being burned. And the English government said, well, we would rather this sort of thing didn't happen here, so let's all just sort of, you know, get along as best we can together. But there were those who just couldn't do that.
Now, there had been persecution previous, and that's why Queen Elizabeth was so intent on that, not returning to those days when people were burnt at the stake and so forth. So when the separatists decided that they couldn't live with the government in England,
go to the continent, and then Huguenots would come from France and live in England and so on and so on. It was a whole melting pot of people moving back and forth, to and fro, because of their religious beliefs.
Now, Holland had recently become an independent nation, having separated itself from Spain, correct?
That's right, yes. Spain occupied what was called the Spanish Netherlands, and the northern provinces, the seven northern provinces, broke away and were fighting for their independence. This was seen as a haven for Protestants from other countries to come and settle it, and the authorities there were more broad-minded, more open, and were happy to have these people settling, and not just for religious reasons, but if they brought their skills with them, they could be useful and so on.
Now, in case you're just joining us, we're talking to Derek Wilson, a renowned historian from the United Kingdom, the author of The Mayflower Pilgrim, Sifting Fact from Fable. It's available from SPCK Publishing, which you can check spck.org.uk in order to find out more about this book and to find more about Mr. Derek Wilson. The Puritans were not being harassed so much in England as they were the subject of satires and so forth. They were being teased a lot about how very different they were, and as you point out in the book, when people set themselves up to be sort of the moral authority, the one and only moral authority, then other people who realize that human beings are fallible are sort of eager to help knock them off their high horse a little bit.
I think that's absolutely true. Yes, I think the persecution, if we want to use that word, was much more a neighborhood thing, really, than a government thing. And looked at the other way round, several of the Puritans had sympathetic support from the local gentry. There were many of the leading gentry or leading leaders of society were Puritans, and they therefore extended their support and their protection to independent, little independent congregations. So it was a much more complex situation than is often reported.
Now, when James the Sixth of Scotland becomes King James the First of England, he tries to maintain the sort of status quo as far as religion goes to a point, but he also considers himself to be kind of an intellectual, and is it fair to say he was more demanding that everybody kind of stay in line, and if you dissent, don't make a big issue of it, even more so than Elizabeth I?
Well, I think you have to consider James's upbringing. And he became king as a child,
right?
And throughout his life, he was under the tutelage of strict Calvinist teachers, and one of the principles of Calvinists, one of the ways they looked at government, was that, yes, okay, the king is supreme in all matters what we might call secular, but when it comes to religion, he is just another layman. So he has to do what the pastor, what the Protestant pastors tell him to do. Now, he grew up, he got rather tired of this, and so when he finally got his freedom, as it were, and could become King of England, he was going to break away from this, and he really did not like Puritans. So when he came to the throne, a lot of church people said, well, now let's have a religious settlement. Let's we have a new king here. Can we all get everything sorted out? And James said yes, yes, yes. So he called a conference at Hampton Court a few months after his accession, and there supposedly laid down what the religion was going to be. But his attitude was very much loaded against the Puritans. He said at one point, "I'm going to harry them from the land." Now, that may sound like quite awful, but in fact, James was always good at saying things, but not so very often good at doing things. And he fancied himself as an intellectual and believed that he was, for example, the peacemaker of Europe and so on. But any kind of consistent policy we look for in vain as regards Puritans. So it was really a mixture as before, that if you kept quiet and kept your nose clean, you'd be okay.
You mentioned two people that are probably not as well known as they should be, and they have a great influence not only at their own time, but also continuing in English religious circles. One of them is Jacobus Arminius. John Wesley would declare himself an Arminius, and that's a theological thing, that that people have the choice as to whether to follow Christ or not, rather than being ordained to say yes or no. That God knows who's going to say yes or no, but he gives us the free choice to make that decision on our own. This was not always universally applauded, was it?
Get on to that. Perhaps we can just sort of finish the story of the separatists.
And, yes.
Some eventually decided to, as you were saying, to go to Holland, to go to the north, to the United Provinces of Northern Holland, and settle there. There, they found two things really. I'd like to talk about. I'll come back to the question of Arminius a little bit later. But what they found was that some of the earlier English settlers had already moved to basically Amsterdam, had now fallen out among themselves. So you had what was called at the time the Ancient Church, which was made up of some of the first English settlers there in Amsterdam. This had now, by the time that the people we think of as the ancestors of the Pilgrim Powers, by the time they arrived in 1608, 1609, this ancient church had split, and you had actually two churches next door to each other and not speaking to each other. So you've got those sort of conflicts going on amongst the English settlers, and then you've got the major theological split in Holland between the followers of strict followers of Calvin and the followers of Arminius. Now, Calvin's big thing is the sovereignty of God. God is sovereign, nothing. His will prevail, whatever happens. Therefore, if some people choose not to follow him, then that's not their choice. But they have been predestined, because nothing can happen which God does not arranged, organized. So if you are on the road to hell, it's not your fault, it's God who has actually set you on that course. Arminius took the view that man has much more free will, and we are all free to choose whether we will follow Christ or not, whether we will follow a Protestant understanding of the gospel or not. This, of course, is anathema to Calvin because it runs straight up against the idea of the sovereignty of God. Man's free will cannot overarch the sovereignty of God. So you've got this major theological debate going on in learned circles in Holland, and that's where some of the English people got mixed up in. And you've got the appalling situation of divisions within the English settlers themselves. So it was that when the people we tend to think of as the forefathers or the Pilgrim Fathers arrived in Amsterdam, they didn't stay there very long. They decamped very quickly to Leiden, which was about 20 or so miles away, which was the intellectual centre of Europe, where they were much happier. And so that was where they lived. For 10 years or so, that was all okay. But then things started going pear shaped.
Now one of the reasons that we've always been taught in the States that the Pilgrims left Holland and made the decision to come to North America was that they were concerned that their children were growing up in a society in a culture where they weren't speaking English, or they were concerned they would grow up to be Dutch citizens and not necessarily English, and that their culture would and their religious sensibilities would eventually be lost as they assimilated into another country. And that was the reason that at that point they decided, if we can't live in England the way we want to live, we can't live here anymore either. That's when they went ship hunting. Is that an accurate thing, or is that overstating the case?
Well, yeah, they were trying to have their cake and eat it, weren't they? I mean, if you go, if you migrate to another country, I would have thought you must accept to a quite a large extent to live in the way that is established in that country. And as you rightly say, they were concerned to lose their Englishness. They were concerned that their children would become Dutch citizens. They might, horror of horrors, they might actually intermarry with Dutch young people, and their distinctiveness would be lost. Had any right if they wanted the protection, the ability to earn a livelihood in that country, could they really expect to dictate the terms of which they should be treated? I don't have, you may have guessed already, I don't have a great deal of sympathy with them from that particular point of view.
And after all, they're the ones that decided to move to Holland. That's, absolutely. You're right. That's exactly what one would expect, that you would assimilate into another country. And so you either had the choice of assimilation or moving, and they chose to move to an entirely new place.
Yep.
You mentioned a lot of the leaders of the various versions of separatists, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, and the other groups that were subgroups within that. You're right, there was quite a potpourri of different versions of separatists in England and in Holland at this time. Was there any one particular thing, other than the assimilation concerns, was there any other particular thing that happened in England that sort of forced their hand to say, okay, now's the time?
Well, I think what is happening at precisely at the same time is the colonization movement. The colonization of the Americas was, as you know, I don't need to tell you your own history.
Yeah.
was set in hand largely by the Spanish and to a certain extent the Portuguese. But by the beginning of the 17th century, countries like England and Holland were catching up. So they were looking for their own colonies. And so Jamestown had been established. And although it was always hoped that they were going to, like some of the southern states, they were going to find gold, or South American states, they would find gold and precious metals and so on. That never transpired. But they had established that there was a viable agricultural product called tobacco, which they could develop. And so they set up colonizing societies, and the major one for England was the Virginia, the London Virginia Company. They were looking for settlers. They would take anybody, to go and settle. And James I claimed a great chunk of the coastline of North America and its hinterland. And the Virginia Company, which is a wholly commercial company, they're looking for profit. We're looking for settlers to go out there to work the land, really much care who these people were, and so you get a hodgepodge of people for various reasons turning to the Virginia Company and seeking their support to move to America. So you would have little jailbirds and landless younger sons and people who had failed at their business in Holland and so on, as well as people who were religiously motivated. The attraction of going to the Virginia Company's settlements in North America was that this was going to be an English company. So at last they could set up an English colony. They would remain English, but they wouldn't actually be very much. They wouldn't be controlled by the English government.
Right, they're far enough away that they couldn't exert too much influence on them.
Yeah.
Now, is this? I know our time is getting close, but this was unusual, wasn't it? That the idea that people would settle in this new world and stay put. Because there had been a lot of incursions by the conquistadors, by the Portuguese, into various parts of Central and South America, but it mostly seemed the idea was, let's find all the goodies and bring them back home. It didn't seem like long-term colonization was really on the plate for them, but it was for the English.
Yes, and it was welcomed by the English government for various reasons. One was the hope of financial gain. You would set up these settlements and they would succeed, and they would pay taxes to the English government. So there was that. Also, as somebody said, I can't remember who it was, said this is one way of getting rid of our riffraff. All undesirables, say jailbirds and inconvenient religious separatists and so on, could all be shuffled off there and be got out of the way. And of course, this is something that an attitude that continued for centuries to come. This was places like Australia and New Zealand and that were populated was by convicts and so on. You've also got people who have simply failed to make a go of things either in England or in Holland and say, let's try something else.
Yeah. I think it fills in a lot of gaps for people to realize that it wasn't just the idea that one day these guys woke up and said, hey, let's just leave England and go off and start our own place. That there were so many factors that led up to these very life-changing decisions that they made, courageous decision that they made to take a dangerous voyage and hope to land in the right place and hope that they survive.
That's right. Yeah. When it came to it in 1620, everything that possibly could go wrong went wrong. the ships weren't up to the crossing. The Virginia Company got sort of sidetracked by a rather unscrupulous merchant called Thomas Weston, who filled the ship up with his own settlers and so on. The settlers were, the travelers were hanging around in England. Their supplies were running out, and some just said, no, we're quitting. We're going to either stay in England or go back to Holland. And so their numbers were diminishing and diminishing until we got to September, when eventually, finally, the Mayflower was able to get underway with a very mixed bunch of people aboard, of which only a few were the original separatists from England.
It is an extraordinary story, and of course we can kind of pick up the thread of it from here. But I found your book so very interesting, and had not thought about the maelstrom of religious thought that was swirling over actually the century leading up to the Pilgrims' decision to pick up and head this way. Really quite honored that we had a chance to talk. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us. Do you have a website people can go to find out more about this book and about your previous books?
Yes, Derek@DerekWilson.com.
Derek@DerekWilson.com. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure.
Yes, sir. Our thanks once again to Derek Wilson, the author of The Mayflower Pilgrims, Sifting Fact from Fable. It's from SPCK Publishing, which again stands for Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. It's based in London. Derek lives in Devon, England, and writes for leading historical magazines. So our thanks for his joining us from all the way from England, and thank you for joining us all the way from your living rooms and your cars everywhere. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. And of course, as we always do, we'll be starting Christmas shows. Please stay tuned for those. And may you and your household have a blessed Thanksgiving. Remember to whom we are grateful for our blessings. We'll see you next time. Until then, God bless.